What do you think of, did you catch it, first of all? A doubter, he says, is someone, how does he say this? I won't get this verbatim, but the essence of what he says is that a questioner is someone who's looking for the truth or for the answers. A doubter is someone who wants to be told there isn't an answer or there isn't truth. And I'm interested to know what you all think of those definitions. There is no right answer.
I'm trying to apply those definitions to people that I know in my mind, and I can find a lot of questioners, but I have a hard time finding a doubter, like a true doubter in that sense of the definition. Because I guess I know a lot of avid atheists, but I don't know that they want to know that there's no truth in the world. But
no divinity is not the same thing as no truth.
Mm. Yeah, that's maybe what it is.
Is that part of that?
Yeah. They don't want to find truth in divinity. They want to try and find truth in other things. Maybe that's... Would that make them a doubter or a questioner? Do you think this definition was pertaining just to faith?
It's a good question.
If someone's a self-proclaimed atheist, haven't they then in fact labeled themselves as a doubter already? As opposed to someone who's just saying they're not sure what... Maybe my definition of atheism is wrong, but isn't that someone who's decided that there is no God, there is no answer?
Well,
maybe there's...
That's a good
because it's
point.
A label in itself, right? So what is it saying
right.
about you to say that you are an atheist?
Well, the word itself simply means, theos. We get this shares a root with theology and theo, and all things to do with God, and ah is Latin, which means without. So, no God is sort of the actual roots of the word, which is not necessarily the same thing as no answer to the question, what is true? It's to presuppose that the answer to the question, what is true, does not include God, or the existence of God, the necessity of the existence of God. Which is partly where I think Black's character's definitions kind of leave something important out. But how many of you, I have some sort of a soft poll in my head about this, but how many of you have been here for the majority of the clips and conversations? Just kind of... Anybody that remembers White's character talking about what he did believe in when he believed in something?
His art and music.
Yeah, the stuff of Western culture, right? Which he says went up the smokestacks of the concentration camps. And that was it for Western culture, as far as he was concerned. And he says in that same moment that he was too enamored with Western culture to notice that it had ended. But when he woke up and went, oh, that's over, he had nothing left to believe in. And so decided to believe in nothing. How many of you would say that you've had a significant experience? You don't have to raise your hand, but if you want to self-identify by saying something about it, would say that you've had a significant experience in your own journey with what we might broadly call doubt. I mean, are people willing to self-identify? That'd be me, for sure. Yeah. It doesn't qualify us uniquely for anything to self-identify that way, but I think it's good to know we have company if we're those kind of folks. I'm tempted, but I won't ask by show of hands how many have never had that experience. We should applaud at the end. Well, let me give us to just chew on a little bit as we go. Tonight, a few thoughts about faith and doubt. Because my working definition of doubt is very different than Black's definition. To me, a doubting person is a person who has... my definition of a doubter is an awful lot like Black's definition of a questioner. To me, a doubter can be... We just really should. To me, a doubter can very much be a person who wants to know that there is an answer to their questions. And for me, that idea has its roots in the shape of a lot of the different pieces of Scripture. And poetry, of course, is uniquely equipped to take us into the land of what's ambiguous, right? What's murky. Psalm 13, the first two verses say this: "How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and every day have sorrow in my heart?" And that sounds to me like someone that is having a pretty dark experience in their life. Somebody for whom, if we want to call faith a light, somebody for whom the light of faith has sort of pretty nearly gone out. Except that this particular psalm has this really interesting kind of already not yet dynamic to it. What are we reading when we read Psalm 13? We're reading a prayer. We're reading a cry of the heart. We're reading something that's just wrung out of the writer's heart. Which then leads me to the question, who's the writer crying out to? To someone that doesn't exist? Oh Lord, how long? What does it matter to be forgotten by God if God isn't there? Like, really? How is it significant in any way? And really, who cares if a figment of my imagination, which is White's perspective on who God is, something we've made up to comfort ourselves, who really cares if a figment of my imagination feels absent? Because if I'm feeling the absence of something that I've made up, all I have to do to solve the problem is make up something that feels present. And I've solved the problem. I no longer have to live with the free-floating sensation of the absence of God. It's really interesting to me that when the light of faith goes out in the life of the psalmist, of the poet, what he sees with remarkable clarity is that he desperately needs the light of the presence of God. Now, what's interesting to me is that it's when he feels the absence of God that he sees most clearly that he wants to know that he is remembered by God. Will you forget me forever? It's in the exact space of a sense of absence that he feels most acutely the desire for presence. He wants to know that he is someone that God notices. How long will you hide your face from me? And when I read that psalm, I just think one way or another, this is the shape of some of the kinds of questions that we shout into the dark, right? That we shout into those moments where we wonder about the existence of God. Are you there? Do you care? Are you just something that exists in my thoughts? Or are you real? Can you do anything about the sorrow in my heart? Who am I shouting at anyway? I like to think of these as things that we can actually only see in the dark. These are things that actually only show up when, if you want to say it this way, when the light of our faith gets dim. And I think that another light becomes visible for the psalmist in the darkness of his doubt, and that's the light of recognizing his own limitations. He confesses in this little portion we read to wrestling with his own thoughts, to feeling like he can't figure it out. And then almost in the same breath he says that there's a sorrow for him that won't go away. Or to put it another way, it's like we hear him saying, this agony in my life, these my deepest longings and my deepest questions, I can't seem to think my way out of them. I can't seem to just crank my brain up to the notch that it needs to be to figure out the answers to these kind of questions. He isn't saying, I guess I should give up on thinking about them. Instead of that, what he's doing is he's acknowledging his own limited ability to come to complete, exhaustive, and certain answers. He's just saying, that's beyond me. And until we come to that point, which can feel like, in our spiritual journey, like a very dark place, I would be willing to contend that we're not ready to receive what God might have for us. Until we can come to a point of saying, I can't actually wrestle this finally and completely down to a non-negotiable, no questions still available to be asked, answer. Until we can acknowledge that, there's some part of us, I think, that still thinks that this is within our grasp to solve without God. Maybe that's just a different way of thinking about doubt. So I want to unpack it just a little bit, because I think at the center of this, of our greatest questions and our greatest dilemmas as human beings, we seem to have this experience where we have enough knowledge, enough wisdom, enough smarts, if you want, to awaken our appetite for great things, for answers, for meaning, but not enough to satisfy them. We've got what we need to get the questions rolling, and really rolling, but not what we need to ultimately nail the answers. Mathematician, Christian thinker named Blaise Pascal, interesting guy, a little difficult to read, but every once in a while he just pulls stuff together. He said it this way. He's talking about what it means to be human. He says, this is our true state. This is what makes us incapable of certain knowledge and of absolute ignorance. We sail within a vast sphere, ever drifting in uncertainty, driven from end to end. When we think to attach ourselves to any point, it wavers and leaves us. Nothing stays for us. This is our natural condition, and yet most contrary to our inclination. We burn with desire to find solid ground and an ultimate sure foundation whereon to build a tower reaching to the infinite, but our whole groundwork cracks and the earth opens to abysses. Sounds pretty grim. But he goes on to this critically important statement. The next sentence he writes is, let us therefore not look for certainty and stability. Now, I mean that to be hopeful, and you've heard me talk about this before if you've been around any amount of time. I believe that certainty is beyond our reach, but meaning, which is far more valuable than certainty, is not beyond our reach. And meaning, I would contend as a believing person, is derived from a relationship with God. It's not based on certainty or conformity. It's actually based on risk and commitment. Different basis. Let me just give us very briefly, and then we'll go on to some worship together, a couple of thoughts about the story of Thomas in the Bible. Thomas, of course, is the archetypal biblical doubter, isn't he? He's been given the appellation. He's doubting Thomas. What a legacy. Stories in John 20, the short version of it goes like this. Jesus has been killed. He's been crucified. His disciples have seen him die. They've seen him be buried. It's over. Some of them have gone to get his corpse, but it's gone. And then, as John tells the story, Jesus appears to Mary Magdalene and then to a whole group of his disciples. And Thomas is not in the gathering. We don't know why. He's just not there. The other disciples that are in that gathering are blown away. They're completely, as you can imagine, they're having a hard time. Jesus is really alive and that he's not a ghost, but they can touch him. He eats some food with them. They're convinced. And when they tell Thomas about their experience, Thomas says, unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe it. And a week later, the disciples are together again. Thomas is there. Jesus shows up again. And this is sort of how that story goes. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. And then he said, really? I just walked through the wall, but don't worry about it. Peace be with you. Then he said to Thomas, put your finger here. See my hands. Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe. And Thomas said to him, my Lord and my God. When I said a moment ago that meaning is derived from a relationship with God, that it's not based on certainty and conformity, but on risk and commitment, here is somebody that actually knows what that means. Because Thomas is someone that has staked everything on his conviction that Jesus is who he says he is, which is God. He's just laid it all on that. And he is the one, Thomas believes, that is the answer to the deepest longings, the most profound hungers in Thomas's life. And then Thomas has watched him die. Now talk about a guy who risked and had the risk go bad. That's Thomas, right? He laid it all on this and it flew apart. If there was ever a person with a reason for doubt, it's Thomas. God's dead and I trusted him. What do I do now? Right? For Thomas, the lights didn't just go out. They got shattered against the wall in an act that was just so violent that it's hard to imagine. And so what does he see in that darkness? He sees two things that change his life and that, for me, replenish my hope. The first is that he sees that there's room in the community of faith for those that have doubt. Jesus just welcomes him right in. He's not in some special subcategory. He's not relegated to a place for doubters that doesn't include those who don't doubt. He's just embraced along with everything and everybody else in the community. Come on in here, Thomas. Maybe it's because the disciples remember their own doubt when Jesus first showed up. Maybe that's why they welcomed him. Maybe they thought, oh yeah, that's right, that's how it felt when we saw him the first time too. I don't know. And he also sees that Jesus himself welcomes him. Jesus does not chastise him. He says, you need to touch my wounds to believe, then start touching. You need to stick your hand in my side. Go ahead. You don't have to stay in this place of being paralyzed by doubt. There's something for you to do. In fact, Jesus not only welcomes Thomas, but he pursues him. He invites him to explore. He invites him to seek in tangible, real ways. He invites him to discover that there can be hope even in the middle of doubt. My hope is that this community of faith can be that kind of a place. I had an interesting experience just before our gathering started with Rob, who's been next door all evening. A lot of the folks from the open mic were coming in through this space because it's where they usually gather. And he popped in. We were just kind of practicing some songs and listened to us kind of fiddle around and get sorted out for a little bit. And then he introduced himself and he said, I'll sum it up because he told me a bit of a story. I grew up Catholic and now I'm part of a Unitarian church. And one of the things that the Unitarian church does is, as part of their framework for belief, is examines other people's frameworks of belief to see if there's something there that we should be taking into ours. And so he just said, what's yours? So we had this interesting little conversation. We haven't had a chance to debrief at all. I keep meaning to ask him what he thought of how that went and some of the answers I gave on behalf of the community without having a chance to consult all of you. But I was very intrigued by his willingness to, as he said, rather than stand outside and speculate with the people on the sidewalk, to come in here and ask the question and find out what this community believes and what sort of community it is. He said, maybe I'll send some of my Christian friends that are, and he kind of paused and he was kind of looking for the words, that struggle with the, and he used the exact phrase that I use all the time, which just kind of made me go, oh, I want to talk some more to you to find out how you're thinking about this, with the prevailing churches. Well, I encouraged him to do that. And I said, our hope is that as a community, we want to be a place where it's safe to explore, to discover what we believe. I know that's not a risk-free venture for a faith community. I know that it's possible to lose any distinctive that would hearken toward what most of us think of as Christianity under that kind of an idea. I know that it's possible to walk away from one of our gatherings wondering if the preacher believes anything for sure. I'm not naive about that. But because I believe that the community of faith, the biblical community of faith, the ongoing community of faith, is meant to have the character of welcoming everyone. I just don't see how that community, if it's well, if it's living as it ought to live, could possibly not also welcome as part of everyone a doubter. What an odd exclusion that would be. I think people of faith who understand that faith in God isn't such a wimpy thing that it can only exist where there's no doubt are people that have the opportunity to welcome both their own doubts as part of the journey of faith and welcome those who have doubts as fellow journeyers of faith. And I think we have the opportunity to do that. The end of Psalm 13, if we skip ahead to there, says this, "But I trust," so this is the same writer who said, "How long, God, how long? How long do I have to wrestle with this? How long do I have to wonder where you are?" This is how he ends the psalm. "But I trust," which means have faith in or take a risk on, "your unfailing love." When do I trust in God's unfailing love? When all my doubts gone? When I'm satisfied that all the questions are answered, that I'm certain of the answers? Or can I do that when I'm in the midst of doubt? I hope I can do it when I'm in the midst of doubt. I think the psalmist does it when they're in the midst of doubt. And I think that as a community of faith, we're called to do it in the midst of our doubts and in the midst of other people's doubts and on behalf of other people's doubts. We actually need one another. And not the least of the reasons for that is that sometimes we need to believe for one another. Sometimes we need to be the person who goes, "You just doubt away. Go ahead, stick your hand in there. See if you can feel the wound. Go ahead and poke around in this Jesus thing and see if there's anything here to actually believe. And don't worry about it. Don't worry about the fact that you have doubts." Doubt and faith are not enemies. They're not opposites. They're actually essential companions. But that's not a tension-free idea. It is a little bit like what happened in the moments in the film, where the filmmaker, brilliantly, I think in this case, has us here in the background of a place that is morally empty from White's perspective. A child playing, leaning on the everlasting arms, not very well. And with that in mind, I encourage us to worship together and to live our faith together with good hope, knowing that we are welcome no matter where we find ourselves on the journey.